ESPN Daily is presented by QuickBooks. Success starts with Intuit QuickBooks. Katie Barnes, the Ivy League Swimming and Diving Championships start today, Wednesday, at Harvard. And this is not an event that usually gets major national attention, but this year is very different. Why is that?
So this year, Leah Thomas, who is a swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania, will be competing for Penn at the Ivy League Championships. Leah is a transgender woman, and she is swimming on the women's swim team, and her success on that team has garnered a lot of national attention all season.
The historic performances of a swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania are getting a lot of attention and fueling a debate over transgender athletes in college sports.
There's buzz that she would become the NCAA's first Division I transgender national champion.
This comes as roughly 280 anti-LGBTQ plus bills have been proposed in state legislatures, targeting transgender youth access to sports and healthcare.
Leah really embodies the nightmare scenario for a lot of people who criticize transgender inclusion in sports, in that she has a history of swimming on the men's team at the University of Pennsylvania, and then for her senior season is swimming on the women's team and is having a tremendous amount of success in doing so. And that has provided a lot of fodder for people who don't think that transgender women in particular should be allowed to compete in girls and women's sports.
And so what's at stake here, Katie, as Leah Thomas is about to take her mark to dive into the pool? Given the backdrop you just gave us, what is on the line here?
Well, it's a simple question of who is allowed to be a woman and who is allowed to win.
Maybe you've heard of Leah Thomas. Maybe you've seen the headlines that have turned an otherwise obscure college swimmer into a frontier in America's unending culture war. But beneath all that outrage and all that disagreement are real questions. Questions about science and inclusion and fairness and the policy trade-offs in between. So today, with Leah Thomas back in the pool, Katie Barnes explains what is really going on here and what this latest debate over a transgender athlete is missing most of all. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, February 16th. This is ESPN Daily. Katie Barnes, the athlete at the center of all of this that people really need to understand and know about is Leah Thomas. So just tell us more about Leah and her history as a swimmer.
So one of the things I do want to acknowledge before I really talk about this is that Leah has not been very vocal throughout this controversy at all. So almost everything we know about her is from a single interview that she's given to the Swim Swam podcast.
Welcome to the Swim Swam podcast. I'm your host, Coleman Hodges. Joining me today is Leah Thomas. She is a swimmer on the Penn women's swim team. Leah, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
And in that, she talked about the fact that she was born in the Austin area, that she's been swimming since she was a child.
So I've been swimming and in the water since I was 5 years old. And so it's been just a huge part of my life for as long as I can remember, you know, and realizing and accepting the fact that I was trans, that sort of sense of certainty and comfort that swimming had always given me was sort of thrown into question.
She went to Westlake High School. She swam at for club swimming at Lost Creek Aquatics, where she still holds a couple of their pool records. And she specializes in distance freestyle.
So Leah Thomas was this talented high school swimmer, someone who committed to UPenn to swim on the men's team, where her brother happened to also be a swimmer there. How would you describe the beginning of Leah Thomas's college career?
Yeah, you know, I think it's fair to say that, you know, Thomas was a good swimmer prior to transition. And so her commitment to Penn, you know, had all those nice little story notes of she was a good swimmer, following in her brother's footsteps. All of that is true. And then at Penn, you had some reasonable levels of success. You know, qualified in the 500 free and the 1,000 free and the 1650 free for Ivy League championships as a freshman, was second team all Ivy during her sophomore season, and swam in the Ivy League championships as well, and finished second overall in, you know, her standard events of the 500, the 1,000, and the 1650.
And so when does Leah Thomas come out and decide to transition? When does the gender identity aspect of her life become to be a public matter?
So after her freshman season in 2018, Leah has said that she concluded that she was transgender and swam her sophomore season, 2018-2019, on the men's team, and then began a medical transition in May of 2019. And so started testosterone suppression and cross hormone therapy. And she came out to the team in the fall of 2019, which is the fall of her junior season.
And the conversations that happened there with the athletic department at Penn, with coaches and so on, how involved were they? How prepared were they for this process and the plan for Leah Thomas to return to swimming?
You know, I think that's somewhat of an open question, because just as Leah hasn't really talked very much about the process or her feelings about everything that's gone on, Penn has also been pretty silent, although they have released a statement in support of Thomas. So from that trajectory, I think it's fair to say that among the coaching staff and Penn athletic staff, that she had a fair amount of support. And, you know, they really affirmed her for who she is.
And there were rules and protocols and regulations that were required for Leah Thomas to compete on the Penn women's team. I mean, we're talking about a certain amount of measurement and monitoring that was continuous. How would you describe what that required?
So at that point in time, the rule for the NCAA was that in order to compete on the women's team as a transgender woman, you needed to complete a full calendar year of testosterone suppression. Unlike other regulations that came out after that particular policy was adopted by the NCAA, there was not a specific hormone threshold placed on what determined eligibility. But from what Thomas had shared in that Swim Swam podcast interview, you know, she said that she monitored like her own level, submitted them for review, and, you know, went through the medical documentation required of a transgender woman to compete in Division I women's athletics per the NCAA policy at that time.
In the summer of 2020, after I had completed my 1 year of testosterone suppression under HRT following the NCAA guidelines, I submitted all of my medical work that I had been collecting for the past year of hormone tests and medical notes from my doctor, and sent all that into the NCAA, and they approved everything and I was clear to compete on the women's team.
And we should be clear about why testosterone is the focus here, Katie, when it comes to these rules and regulations. How would you explain to someone who doesn't understand its importance here why it is so important?
So there's not a focus on testosterone because, you know, when we think about, you know, the primary differences between people who are assigned female at birth and people who are assigned male at birth, you know, the differences in athletic performance, you know, really start to emerge in, well, really during puberty. And for those who experience a testosterone-driven puberty, that is oftentimes what is said as being the primary driver of that difference. And so because of that, there's been a lot of focus on, well, if a person who wants to compete in the women's category and was assigned male at birth but is a transgender woman, they need to demonstrate that they have testosterone levels that are more in accordance with cisgender women or those who assigned female at birth. And so the policy thought behind that is, well, you go on testosterone suppression. It's a common course of transgender affirming healthcare. And so that is why I think the focus has been there.
And so before Leah Thomas swims in that senior season, she has taken, what, 2.5 years then of hormone replacement therapy, suppressing her testosterone?
Yeah, that's right. well and above the 12 months that was originally required by the NCAA. You know, she's been on testosterone suppression for 2.5 years, which is, you know, a long time.
But the point here being that it's not like Leah Thomas was on the men's team one day and then the very next on the women's team. There were changes that attended all of this testosterone suppression in terms of how her body was changed as a result.
Oh, absolutely. It's not like Leah Thomas, you know, is going undercover or is faking being a woman. Like, that's not what's happening here. You know, it's been a long process for her. And I think that's important when we're having this conversation to emphasize, is that this isn't something that was done on a whim. But of course, the nature of her success, I think, is calling into question what is appropriate policy to govern transgender athlete participation, particularly transgender women in women's sports, at more elite level competition.
And the question really does center around the physical advantages an athlete might have if they did go through male puberty, Katie, as Leah Thomas did before she transitioned. And that is a matter of hormone therapy. How much hormone therapy would an athlete need and for how long to remove and nullify what we would think of as the physical advantages of being an adult male? So where is the science and policy on that?
Well, I think there are a lot of questions about that. You know, one of the reasons why there is so much controversy is that this is a really unsettled scientific discussion. It's like, well, what advantages are we talking about? What constitutes advantage? You know, what does mitigating that advantage actually mean? Does that mean reducing it to zero? You know, is it possible to create meaningful competition between transgender women and cisgender women without reducing what some people would argue is an advantage, you know, gained from testosterone-driven puberty to completely nothing? So for someone who experiences prolonged testosterone exposure or experiences testosterone-driven puberty, right, as most people assign male at birth, there are a lot of things that come with that in terms of, on average, increased size, you know, denser bones, bigger heart, larger VO2 max and lung capacity, you know, wingspan. And so there are a lot of studies being done right now in terms of, you know, looking at not just the effect of hormone therapy on some of those other physiological changes and then some additional metabolic changes, but also on their effect on athletic performance. And that, I think, remains the biggest question.
Well, yeah. So basically, there are some things about your body that have changed that suppressing hormones can't undo. But to you, this also raises presumably like a larger, I don't know, philosophical question about regulating advantages and how to be so precise in any of this really at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever we're talking about policy and rules, it's important to know exactly what we're regulating. And when it comes to this particular question around any kind of lingering competitive advantage that Leah Thomas might have or that transgender women like her might have, I think it's fair to say that it's still an open question. And I think that's a really important thing to underscore, is that testosterone, yes, we know a lot of what it does physiologically. Like, you know, ask anybody on the street about what testosterone does. They'll say it makes you bigger, faster, stronger, right? Like,
well, no, Katie, it's steroids. I mean, yes. In the most layman's terms, that's what it is.
Right. Like, there's a reason that, you know, exogenous testosterone is considered to be an anabolic steroid and you can't do it. It's banned. However, when it comes to your endogenous testosterone levels, your naturally produced testosterone, and how that is affected through suppressants or not suppressant if you are a cisgender man and you're competing in men's sports, the actual effect of testosterone on athletic performance is actually a much more gray area, I think, than people expect. And so when we throw then transgender athletes into that, that further complicates how all of these differences between those who are assigned male at birth and those who are assigned female at birth play out athletically, and what is the primary driver for those things.
And it would seem that one of the reasons, Katie, I presume that there is a relative scarcity of studies and research on this is that there are just not that many people in the sample, right? Leah Thomas is a one-of-one example, basically by definition.
Exactly. That's a really big issue. It's not enough to compare athletic outcomes from cisgender men against athletic outcomes from cisgender women, which is where a lot of primary research lies in terms of our understanding of the differences between men and women and their athletic abilities. We need to be looking at, you know, athletic outcomes for transgender people who are transitioning in their teens and how that compares to those who are transitioning in their early 20s and how that compares to people who are transitioning in their 30s. Those are all very different questions, and they're very different physiological questions. They're very different hormonal questions, and that requires a tremendous amount of research and investment. And at that point, then, I think we should know a lot about all of these questions that we have regarding competitive advantage, regarding the effects of hormone replacement therapy, et cetera, et cetera. But as of right now, that kind of data simply does not exist.
So with that as the backdrop, Katie, the one of one, Leah Thomas, is in her senior year. And in December, Penn goes to Ohio for the Akron Zippy Invitational meet. What happened there?
What happened there was kind of a moment that really upended the conversation around transgender athletes, for sure, and certainly upended, you know, Leah Thomas's life. Thomas wins, you know, the 200-yard freestyle, the 500-yard freestyle, and the 1650-yard freestyle. And in doing so, set the nation's top times for the season in the 200 and the 500. A top five time in the 1650, and won the 1650 by 38 seconds. And so that started a very loud and consistent drumbeat of alarm bells around Thomas's success and what that was going to mean for women's sports moving forward. And I think really set the tone for how this conversation was going to go over the next couple of months.
All right, Katie, after the break, we get into what happened over those next couple months and how all of us are supposed to make sense of this now.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Katie, it's Leah's senior season. We're back in the pool. She's breaking records. She's making headlines. Just give us the sort of top line scouting report here. How good is Leah Thomas?
She's pretty darn good. I think there's really no way of getting around that. You know, she was a good athlete prior to transition. She's a good athlete following medical transition.
And the reaction then in terms of her own team, in terms of the people in the swimming community, how would you describe how that's played out?
In the immediate aftermath of the Zippy Invitational in the middle of December, it became quite clear that there was going to be a lot of criticism levied towards Thomas. You know, it just so happened that Penn wouldn't swim for about another month because they were heading into finals and were entering the holiday season. And so the timing was as such that really those who latched onto the story early and were really present were just kind of turning out a lot of criticism and debate that was directed toward Thomas. There were people publishing op-eds that were critical of her. There would be stories with anonymous quotes from teammates and parents of those teammates that were critical. There were a couple of op-eds that were supportive, I suppose, but anything on the record really didn't come out in terms of folks around the Penn swimming program that were defending Leah. Leah hadn't really said anything either, other than that one podcast interview. And so it's been a lot of criticism. You know, I think that's a really fair assessment, honestly.
And I do want to be clear about this too, Katie, because Leah Thomas is not the only stakeholder in this dynamic, so to speak. There are also her teammates, her competitors, certainly the parents of those swimmers, people who feel like, wait a minute, what am I supposed to do here if I am the person now losing to Leah Thomas potentially? So how would you describe that mix of support and also criticism along those lines?
I think it's fair to say that it's mixed. There has been some support. It's been a little bit of a duel of letters, so to speak. The Penn Athletics program released a statement to me that was an unsigned statement of support from quote unquote several members of the women's swimming and diving team. I don't know how many that was supportive of Leah. And then in response to that, 16 members of the swimming diving team, alongside their parents and their families, sent a letter to the NCAA and the Ivy Conference asking essentially that Thomas not be allowed to swim. But that letter was also unsigned and was sent by a three-time Olympic gold medalist, Nancy Hogshead-Maker, on behalf of those families. And then, you know, just last week, 300 members of the swimming community, so competitors at the NCAA Division I, Division II, Division III levels, both current swimmers and alumni, plus some elite swimmers and former elite swimmers, including five of Thomas's current teammates, all signed a letter of support for Thomas that was published by Athlete Ally. And so that, alongside some of the anonymous comments, has really been all that we have heard publicly from Thomas's teammates. And much of it really has been anonymous.
Yeah, Katie, I'm looking at the letter sent by Nancy Hogshead-Maker, the 1984 Olympic swimming gold medalist you just referenced, who said in this letter that the swimmers wanted to avoid retaliation. That's the term that she uses. She says that the swimmers claimed they were told that, quote, we would be removed from the team or that we would never get a job offer, end quote, if they spoke out against Leah Thomas being included in women's competition. Is that a viable concern here? And why is the concern level so high? How would you explain what the motive here on behalf of Nancy Hogshead-Maker would be?
So whether or not that is a viable concern, I think is hard to determine in that really, because so much of this stuff has been anonymous, right? It's, you know, nobody's really gone on the record and talked about it and said, this is what has happened this season. And so doing the reporting to get a number of perspectives to sort of shed light on what has happened has honestly proven to be quite impossible. And to be perfectly honest, a source of great frustration for me. So,
yes.
You know, but I do think that its inclusion speaks to the general tenor of the conversation, which is at times has been really combative. I think at times really, really political. And I think that's really what the concern is here when it comes to this fear of retaliation is that, you know, and I think it speaks to why people haven't really spoken publicly.
I mean, if you are a competitor like Nancy Hogshead-Maker, who, again, won a gold medal in the Olympics, Katie, what is at the root of why this story is resonating so acutely?
So I think it's emblematic in the year that, you know, Nancy Hogshead-Maker won an Olympic medal, which is 1984. And so during that period of time, we know that there was a tremendous amount of doping in women's sports by countries in the East. And that is something that is foundational to Hogshead-Maker's experience. It's something that she's written about. It's something that she has spoken about. And that seems to undergird some of her own motivation in terms of how she approaches protecting the women's sports category, which is foundational to who she is as a professional. You know, she's not just an Olympic medalist. She also is a really prominent lawyer who has done a tremendous amount of work in the Title IX space in advocating for protections for athletes when it comes to issues of sexual assault and sexual abuse. She is a lion in this industry for that reason. And much of why she does the work that she does, and she is the professional that she is because of her desire to, I think what she would describe as protect the integrity of the women's category, and it is impossible to separate that from her own experiences as an athlete. And it's not just, you know, Hogshead Maker, it's also another former Olympic swimmer and Donna DeVerona. The two of them together work with the Women's Sports Policy Working Group, whose, you know, self-professed mission is to essentially find a middle ground between women's sports and transgender athletes. But one of the ways that they go about doing that is certainly advocating for what they see as the rights of cisgender women in this conversation. That is certainly going to be their primary focus, first and foremost, because they've been fighting for the rights of women athletes broadly for decades. I think for them, that's why this is such a fervent issue.
Yeah, Katie, you mentioned Donna DeVerona, this former Olympic swimmer, who has, as a Title IX pioneer, a very specific focus on this issue.
The individuals, the transgender women that have entered the women's category, have done so legally up to this point. Now, new research confirms that there's no way to mitigate sex-linked advantages after puberty. And again, this may depend on the individual. But we are now focused on elite sports. And elite sports is a place and a playing field where for 50 years, women have fought tirelessly to protect the protections that have gained so far.
Yeah, I mean, look, the specter of, to use Nancy's own words here, the specter of doped up East Germans seems to be hanging over this question. It seems like this is a question to so many people about cheating. Is Leah Thomas, by definition of existing in the women's category, cheating? And so, Katie, when you went to Leah Thomas's meet at Harvard, this is not the Ivy Championships, this is a previous meet there. What did you see?
I saw a pretty regular swim meet, to be honest. Thomas swam a couple of races. She won a couple of races. She lost as a member of the relay team. And, you know, gave congratulations to her competitors. They congratulated her. You know, she hung out in the warm-up pool talking with her teammates. It was nothing really out of the ordinary. She was another member of the women's swim team. There were no boos. There were no, like, you know, really loud cheers. There was elevated security outside, actually, which I thought was really interesting. Out of an abundance of caution is what a Harvard spokesperson told me. Because of all of the attention that has been following Thomas around this season. But other than that, there wasn't really anything out of the ordinary. And even as she won, she didn't win by a tremendous amount. Actually, what's interesting and of note is that since the Zippy Invitational, she has not posted times that have been close to that. So, you know, at conference championships, it's going to be really interesting exactly what time she swims.
Yeah, Katie, I've been listening and watching these conspiracy theories crop up about how Leah Thomas had been tanking those races, actually, because she wanted to diminish the perceived advantage that she has in the pool. But as for the actual policy here that governs her ability to be in the pool for next month's NCAA championships, I mean, that has just been a giant mess. Right? Because the NCAA, because of all of this controversy, said last month first that they would defer to the individual sports governing bodies on gender eligibility. And for swimming, that's a group called USA Swimming. But then USA Swimming very conspicuously changed its policies after that to more stringently regulate the hormone levels required to swim as a woman. And so the NCAA then decided not to defer to USA Swimming and just stick with the rules they had before. And so basically, Leah is expected to be able to compete in the NCAA championships next month, but this has just been a massively tangled web of changes across this entire crazy bureaucracy.
Yeah, Pablo, it's so complicated that, you know, they've been changing all of these really small details, and we're talking about things like what testosterone level threshold is appropriate or the length of time required for testosterone suppressant, what specific ages it affects. All of those policies are really in flux because there's been a lot of changes, not just at the NCAA level, but also at the international level with changes that the Olympic Committee has made in recent months as well. We would literally be here all day if we went into all of it.
Yeah, it's like you click on the Apple Terms of Service, right? It's just sort of like, there's way too much here. Get me to the actual, like, Cliff Notes summary. But the other organization I am curious about here, Katie, as the Ivy League Swimming and Diving Championships begin, is the Ivy League itself. What have they said throughout all of this?
The Ivy League put out a statement in support of Thomas ahead of her first swim after the holiday break in early January. And then after the NCAA changed its policy in the middle of the season, executive director of the Ivy League, Robin Harris, came out very strongly in opposition to that decision.
I was absolutely flabbergasted when I heard the timing of the application of the new policy, the fact that it was literally going to be in effect mid-season, mid-year, effective for student athletes currently competing. I was shocked, I was dismayed, and I was angry. This is completely unprecedented timing.
And from her perspective, it felt very targeted to one of her athletes. And so she came out very strongly against that and has made it very clear that the Ivy League will be allowing Thomas to swim at the Ivy League Championships. Her eligibility is not in question, no matter what the NCAA has said for its changes regarding the 2022 championships.
Yeah, Katie, I still have questions about where Leah Thomas fits into the larger landscape of political legislation, like in state houses. And I'll ask you about that after the break.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So the last time we talked on this podcast, Katie, it was about the many states that were debating whether to pass legislation around trans athletes and who could or could not compete in youth sports as a boy or a girl. And I remember you telling me that the people who opposed transgender inclusion in these state houses had a very specific fear, a very specific worst case scenario, but that they didn't have a real case study for it. Because basically they were all worried about trans women competing against those assigned as female at birth and just dominating women's sports as a result. That was the fear that they had. That was the fear they were selling. And we didn't have examples of that, really. But now we do in Leah Thomas because she has performed so well in the Ivy League.
You're absolutely right. And now what we're seeing is in states that are considering this legislation, notably Arizona and Indiana, Leah Thomas is coming up as an example for why the legislation is needed in those states to, quote unquote, protect girls and women's sports from being dominated by transgender women. And they use Leah Thomas as an example for why that needs to happen.
Yeah, the fear, again, to be very blunt here, seems to be that you're going to have these men cheating our girls out of their trophies.
Yeah, that is really explicitly the fear. And I think that's a really important distinction to make, is that when we're talking about what this legislation seeks to do and how that conversation is being shaped, it is often being shaped by a fear of boys who identify as boys and are assigned male at birth somehow taking advantage of rules to participate in girls and women's sports and rob girls and women of opportunities for medals and scholarships and success, etc. There are no examples to this day of boys masquerading as women to set records and steal scholarships. There are examples of transgender women who are seeking to compete in girls and women's sports and who have had some levels of success. And there are also examples of transgender women who have competed in girls and women's sports who have had very little success. And so the prevalence of this quote unquote problem, I think, is really up for debate. It depends on who you talk to.
And there is this fascinating conversation, Katie, that's happening in the Ivy League, because Leah Thomas is not the only trans swimmer in the conference. There is another one, except that that person doesn't seem to be drawing as much attention.
That is true. There is another transgender swimmer competing in women's swimming in the Ivy League, and that is Isaac Hennig, who's a transgender man who's competing in women's swimming for Yale. And has actually swum head-to-head against Leah Thomas and has beaten her. And that did actually garner a lot of attention for the sensationalist reasons that I'm sure you can imagine. But when it comes to how we talk about transgender athletes, even just that phrase garners a specific image, and that is of a transgender woman competing in women's sports. Transgender men are often absent from this conversation. And I think that absence, honestly, kind of illuminates some of the underlying assumptions that we make when we are talking about transgender athletes. And that is that fundamentally, there is a lack of belief that somebody who is assigned female at birth could compete with somebody who's assigned male at birth. In Isaac's case, it's worth noting that under the NCAA guidelines, you cannot medically transition if you are assigned female at birth and want to compete in the women's category if you are a transgender man. So he cannot, by rule, go on testosterone.
And so here we are, Katie. We're looking ahead to the NCAA championships after this week's Ivy League championships. The NCAAs are scheduled for March 16th through 19th in Atlanta. What have Leah Thomas's competitors said ahead of that?
Honestly, not much, but there has been a notable statement from Stanford swimmer and Olympian Brooke Forty, who has won an NCAA championship in the 500 free. And she said that, you know, she welcomes Thomas's competition and has respect for her. And specifically in the statement that she shared, she said, and I quote, "I believe that treating people with respect and dignity is more important than any trophy or record will ever be, which is why I will not have a problem racing against Leah at NCAAs this year," end quote. And what struck me about that statement is it reminded me a lot of what one of Andrea Yearwood's competitors said to me a long time ago. And Andrea Yearwood is a transgender girl who also was subject to a lot of scrutiny when she was running in the state of Connecticut. And one of her competitors said literally almost the same thing to me at that time about how, you know, being supportive of Andrea was more important to her than winning a championship, even as Andrea beat her for her state championship that year. As I reflect, I think, on all of this, you know, one thing that I think really gets lost in this conversation, and even in the conversation that we had today, right, where we're talking about hormone levels, about medical transition, about rules and policy, is that we sort of lose the humanity of the moment of, you know, what these transgender athletes are really going through, of just like the humanity of just people who like to play sports, right? Like, sports is such a fundamental cultural experience in our society, especially American society. And we get just really kind of twisted in knots around regulating it sometimes. And we boil down a lot of these really big, important questions to what somebody's hormone levels are and what they should be.
Yeah, Katie, I'm reminded that for so many people listening to this, this is a curiosity of a story or maybe a heated political debate of a story, but for you, it is something different. It is something that you have been thinking about long before this news cycle happened. And so the downstream consequences of this conversation, how do those weigh on you?
So the first story that I published on transgender athletes at the high school level was in May of 2018. And really since that moment, I have continued to report in this space and see up close the effects of this conversation on youth and their families. The Trevor Project has released a tremendous amount of data that shows that the overwhelming majority of LGBTQ people broadly are suffering from negative mental health outcomes because of the proliferation of legislation around the country targeting young transgender people in terms of their access to sports, sometimes their access to bathrooms and locker rooms. You know, there's a bill pending in Florida that would restrict the language that teachers can use around LGBTQ people in the classroom. And so there are a lot of bills affecting LGBTQ people from all walks of life and transgender people specifically that are being heard around the country. And as a reporter, you know, I hear the fear from families, from young people, from advocates that they're experiencing in this moment around what it means to be a queer person and to be a trans person right now. And it's so heated and so charged. And we talked about that with the fear that Leah Thomas's teammates have expressed around not feeling like they can speak publicly, the lack of voices from around the Penn program, I think, sheds a light on the fact that people are feeling very uncomfortable in terms of having these conversations. And a lot of it comes from not just, you know, the difficulty of the concepts and of explaining what's going on, but also of just the tremendous amount of scrutiny placed on all people, but certainly disproportionately trans people in this conversation. And for me, as a journalist who covers this issue, and not just a journalist, but somebody who also is non-binary and is trans, that is also something that I feel in terms of how people will interpret my reporting and what it means to be a reporter in this space when the stakes are really high and there's so much emotion. And how, you know, it's not just the subjects and the sources that I work with who feel that vulnerability. I feel it too.
Katie Barnes, thank you as always for your reporting and your voice.
Thanks for having me, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.